Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K at the University of Minnesota, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks.
This week on Culture Q, bring it back.
His name is Rusty, for obvious reasons when you see him.
You know, these are 30-plus-year-old machines that really were only designed to last 6 or 7 months.
It's something that's cheeky and sassy and on the edge of sexy without crossing the line.
Dance music is kind of an experimental dance music, but instead of samples, I use robots that play drums.
Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Noel Clark. Retro seems to be all the rage these days. From fashion to food to music, everything is coming back around again. So this week, we're looking into the past and bringing it back in the form of landmarks, ladies, robots, and video games. We start with a story from Markita Fornoff on the new pinup movement in Minnesota, and then visit an 80s video game arcade on a quest for survival. Next, Amy Friedman has the story of an ad firm who projects their image into the past, and Matt Curtis checks out a musician who is building his own band. Toss in a dash of Daft Punk, and you've got Culture Q, starting right now. In February of 2012, three women set out on a mission to empower others using an unlikely platform, a quarterly pinup magazine. With field help from reporter Mike Potter, producer Markita Fornoff sets out to find out just how empowering women find Minups magazine.
For some, the 1950s can be described as quintessential Americana. The economy was booming, suburbs were growing, and new household technologies were popping up left and right.
There was a time when the prospect of washing a stack of dishes like this would send cold chills up my back. But those days are gone forever, ever since I got this, my Frigidaire automatic dishwasher.
Social movements, political ideas, and home appliances have changed since then. But the ideal imagery of the 1950s is finding its way back into the modern picture. Don Felice Warnicki is editor-in-chief of Minups and a self-described plus-sized pinup. As a mother of six, it's important to Warnicki to keep the magazine family-friendly. She describes pinups of Minups this way.
Not necessarily straight vintage. You know, for me, a pinup, you know, I have this, but a pinup is like this. She's just covered in ink, and she's gorgeous. You know, it's something that's cheeky and sassy and on the edge of sexy without crossing the line to overtly sexy.
But towing the line between what's empowering and what's sexist can be tricky. Vanessa Messersmith is both a stylist and the owner of Blacklist Vintage in Minneapolis. And she has some reservations about pinup culture.
And like this whole idea of putting so much focus and emphasis on your body in taking clothes off. And I don't know, it's so, I don't know, sometimes it just really appears like we're going backwards as far as women's rights.
It's not so much the amount of skin that's showing, which can be off-putting to Messersmith. It's more so the politics that are associated with that time period and style.
Back in the 80s, women were wearing power suits, you know, to make them look more masculine, and the style was like really kind of jagged and not soft at all, even in the 90s. And then suddenly, at this time period, women are wearing pink and really soft materials and things that accentuate their curves.
Since the 1950s, the FDA approved birth control as being safe. The Equal Pay Act was put in place, and affirmative action was extended to also prohibit discrimination based on gender, which is why celebrating an earlier era might seem like a step backward. But these advancements could also be used to explain the revival of pinups as well.
I wonder if it's almost like women are becoming more secure in their role in society, in gender equality, that they no longer feel like they need to make a stand against a homemaker lifestyle. It's a choice to be that homemaker instead of being forced in that position.
But according to Messersmith, the answer will never be black and white.
People are complex, which is awesome.
Warnke was conscious of these complexities and tried to address them from the start.
When we first started looking at doing the magazine, I wanted to really look into whether or not it was going to be sexist. If it was going to be empowering to women, how people were going to perceive it.
After speaking with a feminist studies professor at the University of Missouri and the author of Pinup Girls, Warnke concluded that
it actually is a feminist movement.
This is something that Messersmith is still on the fence about.
It's really difficult for me because, like, some people say with feminism that a woman can choose to be revealing and show off whatever, but oftentimes I wonder, like, it feels like it's always through a man's filter.
But Christy Williams, a photographer and one of the co-founders of Minups, is changing that. Working with Williams made Warnke at ease and gave her the confidence to step in front of the camera.
I walked away from that with a completely different mindset about who I was. I was so much more empowered. I felt beautiful. I felt powerful. I felt like I was portraying my own sexuality and my own personality in a positive light in the way that I wanted it to be perceived.
Minups is still in its first year, but Warnke has seen this transformation happen, and other women as well.
They come in and they're a little nervous, and they're coming a little schlumpy, you know, and then they get all hair and makeup done. And by the time they're done, especially if they come with friends, they're so much lighter and brighter, and they tell us all the time, this changed my life, I look at things differently. And through the magazine, I haven't had a single person tell me, I don't want one of my images in the magazine.
Parts of the pinup culture might get negative reviews, but Warnke hopes that her publication will help the audience create a positive self-image, especially for the younger girls, like her daughter.
I don't want her to grow up with the hang-ups that I had. I want her to always feel beautiful and smart and amazing, because she is beautiful and smart and amazing. I want her to start out feeling that way.
For Culture Q, I'm Markita Fornoff. Mike Potter helped contribute to this report.
Sage Spirito spends his days solving puzzles, repairing ancient machines, and collecting coins from wooden boxes. Sure, this might sound like the plot of a video game, but for Sage and the gang at Rusty Quarters Retro Arcade, it's just another day at the office, and their adventure is just beginning. Think about your favorite video game. You step into the role of the unlikely hero whose path is forever changed in an instant. For Sage Spiritos, that instant was the day his Minneapolis business went under.
When we first opened, we were a small novelty shop.
In this dark time, our hero usually discovers a hidden talent or a secret power that marks the beginning of their journey. Spiritos possessed a hidden power of his own.
And I had some games from my private collection.
A love of vintage arcade games.
And it was Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., and Defender. And we ended up getting more adults play those than actual children. And it got to the point that we had a line of adults outside the door.
Spiritos and his wife Annie were determined to keep their dream alive. So they liquidated everything in the novelty shop, purchased more arcade cabinets, and reopened as Rusty Quarters, a neighborhood arcade dedicated to vintage games. Rusty Quarters gets a fair amount of business from foot traffic to the bars and restaurants in the neighborhood, but even with the occasional kids' party, the winter can be very slow.
It's hard running your own business, especially a small business, and especially with, you know, such a novelty business like a 80s retro arcade. There is a lot of fans out there, a lot of fans in Minnesota. It's just one of those really hard businesses to get off the ground.
In this stage of their journey, they sometimes spend more coin than they make and have to do battle with the sinister beast, the Rent.
And we had problems catching up with the Rent, and, you know, we're trying our best to catch up right now.
Because Rusty Quarters has only been open for a year and a half, the danger of an untimely demise is still very real. But there are veterans in the arcade business who can provide a glimmer of hope to our heroes in their hour of need. Art Santana is the manager of Ground Control, a classic arcade in Portland, Oregon.
These guys had always wanted to run an arcade, first and foremost. They wanted to preserve classic arcade gaming and be like Kevin Flynn from Tron, you know, like have their own awesome 80s arcade.
I kept dreaming of a world I thought I'd never see. And then, one day, I got in.
But they saw that business kind of dropped off in the evenings and things were a little slower than they needed to be in order to make it sustainable.
Ground Control has three times the space of Rusty Quarters and evolved out of a necessity to include a bar and lounge after the previous owners sold the business in 2002.
So during the day, kids are welcome to come in and play dozens of classic arcade games and pinball tables that we have. But at night, it's adults only and we serve a full bar and food and things like that. So adults can come down and hang out and play a lot of the games that they grew up playing.
But simply buying a magic potion or two doesn't solve every problem for our brave arcade owners. Sometimes in life, like in any good game, you need to shell out some cash for new equipment. Ground Control can afford to repair most machines pretty quickly, and they even reproduce some parts on their own to make them stronger and more durable.
It is very difficult and expensive keeping the games going, and it can be frustrating, but it's worth it because if you don't have the original controls and the original gameplay, it kind of defeats the purpose of what we're doing.
With two full-time repair technicians and a part-time staff to help with cleaning and maintenance, the team at Ground Control are well-equipped to battle through the tough times. But what of our fledgling arcade owner, Sage Spiritos?
I would have to say probably 80-90% of the repairs I do myself. It was really hard to begin with because I didn't know what to look for. But, you know, these are 30-plus-year-old machines that really were only designed to last 6 or 7 months out. And there's a basic checklist of things. It's mostly just burnout fuses.
Thankfully for Spiritos, the destination is only half the fun. The journey itself is just as rewarding.
I love soldering things. Sometimes you just get stumped, but when you can figure out a problem, fix it, it's everything in the world. It just, you know, it's a wonderful feeling.
After close to 10 years in the arcade business, Art Santana agrees.
You can look at things like that and attack things in that way, and hopefully you get to level up, you know, at the end of the day and reach a new goal.
And, of course, Spiritos and Rusty Quarters help out by doing what any good hero does: giving back to the community.
If somebody doesn't know how to play a game, we'll definitely take time out to show you or explain how things work. We'll actually even pull out games if you want to see, you know, how a game works, especially with kids. Kids are always learning and asking questions, and there's never a dumb question, and we're here to help. And, you know, we just want people to come down and have a good time.
On to the next adventure. This is Noel Clark for Culture Cube. Advertising company Carmichael Lynch is so modern that some of their office chairs are exercise balls. There's even a swing in the lobby. But amidst this beacon of forward thinking sits an old, rusted piece of Minneapolis history. Producer Amy Friedman has this story.
You may not even realize you know Carmichael Lynch, but chances are you've seen their work.
Come and get it!
Jack Link's Beef Jerky presents Messin' with Sasquatch.
This Jack Link's commercial was broadcast across the country, and most of Carmichael Lynch's business operates on a national, not local level. But on the roof of their office in downtown Minneapolis stands a constant reminder of exactly where they're from. You just have to trek 12 floors in an elevator and a flight of stairs to find it.
Just keep going up, up, up.
Here, in the open air and with a flawless view of Minneapolis, stands a 100-year-old, rust-covered water tower.
the water tower, we came to find that it was on the historic registry.
This water tower may be out of sight for most of the workers, but it has become a part of the Carmichael Lynch team. Tracy Pleshcourt, self-proclaimed company historian, talks about the tower like he's a person.
His name is Rusty, for obvious reasons when you see him. He has his own Spotify account. He has his own Facebook page, so a lot of people mention him in their posts.
People really connected with Rusty. And he could be seen all over Minneapolis. These two things made him the perfect medium for public art. Perfect except for one thing.
Because it's on the historic registry, there are a lot of rules attached to what you can and cannot do to it. One of it is alter it in any physical way. And so we had to get pretty creative about you know, our way of branding it.
The answer to this problem was projection. So the company began projecting images onto Rusty in 2010.
You know, after we moved in, we had heard that the Twins were going to build Target Field adjacent to our building. And so now, ironically, we have 40,000 faces looking at that water tower at any given game.
The original design was simple. A basic yet endearing cartoon face, just two eyes and a mouth, that peered down over the city. And this year, they ran a competition for Minneapolis College of Art and Design students to create a new design. Out of 40 submissions, Josh Olson won this competition with a variation on the original.
I recorded a few tests of just my face where I imitated Rusty, which was the original projection that they had on the water tower that they were going to be replacing. It's probably the biggest self-portrait that I've ever seen. It's kind of like I'm watching over Minneapolis in a weird way.
And with this, Rusty was transformed from antique to public art.
Public art can be a hard thing to get into, actually, like finding the right venues to put it and getting the right stuff approved to display within the city. So I think it's really cool that an advertising firm like them would do something for public fine art.
It makes you wonder, why would an advertising company be interested in fine art? That cynic in all of us wants to pass it off as marketing, good PR.
I do know that because it has gotten, Rusty has gotten a lot of PR, people certainly have. I can identify us through seeing the water tower. Was that on purpose? Not really. You know, that just kind of evolved.
But I also spoke to Sandy Boss Febo, who headed this project. She thinks the project is more than just a billboard.
If I can loosely speak for my agency, we were all very involved in the community, and our surroundings have a big impact on the work that we create. And I think the more that we're involved with it, and the more that we interact with it, and the more that we invite participation from others, the better that our work is. You know, it just makes the day more interesting and a lot more fun.
While most of the work at Carmichael Lynch takes place in an office, they know that's not where the inspiration comes from. For that, sometimes you have to step outside, take a deep breath of painfully cold Minneapolis air, and take a walk through your own neighborhood. For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
Doing monotonous tasks is not on Patrick Flanagan's list of favorite things. That's why this Minneapolis musician is breaking through the regular characteristics of dance music with a whole new set of rules, even though they might seem a bit robotic. Producer Matt Curtis visited his studio in downtown Minneapolis to learn more about this unique musical experience.
One man, one take.
But it didn't take 13 minutes and 38 seconds to make this fascinating, so dubbed, DIY Afro-Baroque Electro House song. It took over 3 years, building the electronics, the software, and developing the raw talent to take on such a task as creating a semi-automated band.
So I'm surrounded by, five or six machines that look like antique furniture, but they play drums.
This man is Patrick Flanagan, also known as Jasari, his stage name. He is a graduate of Columbia University and the University of Minnesota in music composition. He has been redeveloping what he dreamed his music could be in the strangest of ways for half a decade, and he's not even close to being done yet.
Which I would, sort of locate in dance music. It's kind of an experimental dance music, but instead of samples, I use robots that play drums.
If a master of composition were to pursue experimental dance music, I imagine it would be something like this. Just like an orchestra, Patrick's studio is a visual spectacle as well as audio, and that's just the way he likes it.
The original motivation was to create something that had a sort of, that was theatrically compelling. I used to do live laptop music prior to doing this, sort of experimental electronic music. But that was always me behind a computer on stage, which is kind of dull to watch. And so I thought if I built machines that played drums, I'd have more of a theatrical spectacle, some more stage presence for that kind of music. There are a lot of tools out there that make making music easier than ever. You know, it's easy to get a pretty good sounding dance track out of Ableton Live pretty quickly. The downside of that capability is that a lot of music being made today sounds more or less the same. So I put a lot of time into creating my own tools. You know, it's a more labor-intensive process, but the result ends up sounding, unique or at least different than what's out there.
Yeah. And Patrick is not alone in this opinion. I had a chance to speak with Peter Lansky, well known around these parts as the creator of Too Much Love, a local DJ exhibition held at First Avenue, as well as DJing himself. He expressed his own feelings towards the typicalities of the genre.
Most new DJs now will just rely on a computer to beat match for them. Looping tracks can be an easy way to mix tracks. Right now I'm into kind of like electronic music more on the fringes, I guess you might say, of electronic music. Music that sort of just plays with boundaries and expectations and focused on rhythm and texture and sound more than just hooks and pop hooks and big drops.
Jasari's debut EP, The Human Element, dropped earlier this month, and by suggesting that the human component of his music is a mere element, it illustrates how he utilizes, but does not depend on, the mechanical tools and instruments he created. He isn't just a sole performer, but a frontman of a robotic band, and it's that human element which Patrick considers to be the most important part.
It makes it easy to play rhythms that would be very difficult for a human being. Like I can play, I can get 30-second notes by holding down a button. The point is not to just be better than people, it's to explore a different set of possibilities.
Interestingly, Patrick is against making easy music for himself, but encourages others to in his Android and iPhone apps. Vio for iPhone and Transform Your Voice, soon coming to Android, allows the user to vocode their voices and apply them to songs with a simple swipe and click. A delicate balance between ease and originality become apparent. Putting a user-friendly music creator into something as universal as a phone allows others to easily experiment in the simplest of terms, in hopes that they pursue a more comprehensive way, as Patrick and Peter do.
So I don't think it's weird that people are DJing with computers at all. Like, it just makes sense, because that's how people listen to music and consume and buy and steal music.
Patrick argues that anyone can create music now. And if making pretty good music is easier to do than ever before, then making great, unique music is harder than ever. Distinguishing oneself from every other laptop or iPhone DJ is imaginably difficult. But from the looks of Jasari, it might help to have a few robots on hand to ensure your sound and style is still original. This is Matt Curtis with Culture Q. Binary
solo. 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 0000001 Once again, without emotion, the humans are dead.
Hi, I'm Steve Fisher. I'm very persnickety when it comes to music, but there is one band I hold unconditional love for, Daft Punk. In anticipation of Daft Punk's upcoming album, I've lined up five songs that, to me, complement the different parts of a day. This is Soundscope. I begin in the morning. It's winter, and the sun has not risen. There's a silence in the air, and everything is peaceful. Night Vision is a song by Daft Punk that reminds me of the morning. It's devoid of abrupt noise, and its smooth ease makes me think of a slow dream, the type of dream that you just come out of when you wake up. The morning fog has cleared. I see myself sitting in a hallway outside a classroom. In a few minutes, class will start, and another day as a student begins. This song is called Aerodynamic. To me, it's uplifting, quick, and exciting, just like what the beginning of a day entails. The day is in full swing, and all the problems it's thrown at you have been circumvented with laser precision. This is Robot Rock. It's night, and you've reached your peak. You're happy about what the day has brought, and ready for the next day, one more time. One more time. That's my list of the top five Daft Punk songs to get you through your day. This has been Steve Fisher for Culture Q.
Thanks for listening. That's our show. This week you heard from Markita Fornoff, Noel Clark, Amy Friedman, Matt Curtis, and Steve Fisher. Producers for Culture Q are Mitch Skinner, Markita Fornoff, Amy Friedman, and Matt Curtis. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and your host and managing editor is Noel Clark. You can find archives of our show on RadioK.org or listen live on the Radio K iOS app, available at the iTunes Store. We'll see you next week. It's in the garage. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.